Are questions for Barry? Any questions?
I haven't read half those books.
Yeah, but you've been doing useful work engineering.
Well, I did notice as you went through, because you were talking about different appreciators of time. The Slaughterhouse Five.
Yeah, it's a very good one. Yeah,
with a mixture of time travel.
Yes.
There was I can't use my Sorokin, a book about a person on the point of death is offered the opportunity to go back to start again. Now his life was a miserable, he kept failing. And he was offered the opportunity by the devil to go back and start again with the memory, complete memory, he has at the point of death. And it's about his extra frustration of never being able to do anything other than follow exactly the same route.
Right.
You know, circumstances just conspire
against him.
Drives the devil.
And he's got a...
The reiteration, of his life was like an eternal damnation.
Yeah.
There's Damon Runyon, who only wrote in the present tense. All his short stories. Apparently someone says he wrote one verb that wasn't present tense.
Is that so? And I've read quite a few of his and I'd forgotten that. That's good.
That's good. The last one was Lazarus, the concept of Lazarus being brought back from death. And then question, never being able to die? Because that would criticise Christ, so to speak.
Yes.
So there's the concept of horror in eternity of reliving, which might apply to memory as well as to physical life.
Yes.
There's a couple of novels about Lazarus.
And
his family saying, we don't want you.
There's lots of interesting ones, I guess. Yeah. And I kept clear of sort of anything to do with time travel except through the memory. And any form of science fiction is not a genre that I tend to read. But I'm not sure that tells you very much about time, except what happens is in the future, and you've got different technologies, actually.
No, the Slaughterhouse Five is a different first.
Yeah, that too.
I have to read one or two other things now. I have to read them now.
Yeah, well, it's over a lifetime. I perhaps ought to add that it's just the idea for doing this came from a particular thing I've been puzzling over. I should say it's, well, the Laurie Lee book about being fat with time, I read in early middle age, I would say, and I felt, golly, I no longer feel fat with time. There's a definite sense of mortality being more imminent than it was. And then I came across, I would say about 15 years ago, the Zorba quotation that I gave to you. I was on holiday with you, Anthony, in Greece, and I was reading Zorba the Greek, and I saw that little passage, and I've been agonizing it about ever since, how you spend what is left to you. And I really haven't, I know that people that just keep doing, and others have a more serene way of life being. And others say, take the Buddhist solution down the middle or something like that, you know. But it's a super question, and I think it does involve time, and time with an ending and the sense of mortality. And I was very moved by the sections on Burney that I told you about, the guy in the, might be executed at any time.
Yes, I thought that would be good for the Buddhist meditation. And I think, you know, it rounded off the seminar nicely. So it's a presentation on the theory of time, and then a presentation on the perception of time. What memory do you think of a fruitful line of further thinking, the linkages to be made between theory of time and perception of time? Is there anything, or are they both completely different things?
Well, I think you read some of the sources on this, and you do find that an article will often separate itself into psychological experience time, and others getting to the hard stuff. But I became very interested. I had to do a lot of background reading. I became very interested in McTaggart's theory of time, which I actually alluded to, and I think it makes sense. We know what we mean by past, present, and future, and so on. And it's really strange. I read several quite long articles on time, and McTaggart always had a large section within it. Even an article in the Stanford Encyclopedia on Christianity and Eternity, there was Phil McTaggart. And I think that is what has interested me coming out of this more than anything else, because I just cannot believe he's got it right. He's just trying to figure out how he did that. But I think his notions are things that seem to chime with everyday kind of experience. And from my own penny book, for what it's worth, it seems to me that he's trying to prove that time, real time, not experience time, is not real and does not exist. And that he does this through a logical deduction, through saying that past, present, future involves a contradiction, and the main argument against it is incoherent because it is circular. Therefore, it must be the case the past, present, the A series is actually will not work, and therefore the B series is false, and therefore he deduces from that that time is not real. Now, I didn't think you could, by logic alone, deduce the ontology of something. That's my problem with that. But I don't know, other people might have another view.
As I recall, did he say something about there was a C series? So he said that the A series and B series
didn't
exist. I didn't understand what a C series was.
Well, only because I've read it recently. The A series is past, present, and future. The B series is static points along a line where you can say this is before and this was after. Napoleon died before Victoria and so on. The C series is the same line with the temporality removed. The events are there in a fixed order, but we don't know which way time goes. Does it go this way or does it go this way? So what he then says is that in order to give temporality, I can't say it, to the B series, you actually need the C series to give it its order, so that's one necessary condition, and the A series to give it its temporality, and that's the second necessary condition. And the C series really then falls away because it's done its work. But having established that, he thinks, by actually proving that the A series has an inherent contradiction, and you cannot object to that, because you prove A series incoherent, it necessarily follows that the B series cannot work either, and therefore our conceptions of time are unreal.
So I got the ones dependent ones almost like a subset. B is almost like a subset.
Yeah.
So I thought the C was his answer, but you're saying that it isn't. So he says that you use the C, but he still disappears because it's a subset.
I think so. It's merely a provenance how you get to the B series, I think. Yes.
All right.
We've heard one or two earlier talks about backward causation. I just thought that this is really not a question, but an addition to what you said. In the story of Oedipus, as told by Socrates, Oedipus lives a very successful life, and then suddenly he discovers that for the last 20 years he's been married to his mother. And so that causes, in his own mind, in the mind of the audience, it causes the whole of his past life to be a sham. Up to that point. So in terms of the way you experience things, it is possible, like you said, to experience backward causation. Something happens now which causes the last 20 years to be a totally different 20 years from the ones I thought they were. Is that a reasonable addition to what you said, or makes sense?
Yes, I understand, I think, what you say, but I suppose it's a common experience that in any present moment we may find something that makes us reinterpret the past. Like one discovers one's wife is unfaithful. That may sort of, you know, bring something. And where that is with backward causation, I'm not sure. Or is it merely that we didn't have a true notion of the past leading up to the present moment, rather than being backward causation itself? Yes. Yes.
But I can see how you would feel that way.
What I didn't understand at all is how you could have reverse time. And I think this has been mentioned all, you know, it's a bull in the china shop. I just can't see, and the omelets and stuff, yes. You know, I just can't see how you can suddenly reverse time and everything sort of fits back oddly. It doesn't seem to make any sense. Which is why, apparently, Einstein thought that time is unidirectional, because above all, it's causation.
I wonder if it's different flows, going back to your Russians, and you were saying different flows within time. So, with those advanced and retarded ways, I think they said the reason we didn't see the ones that go back in time is they all cancel out. So we're just left with this tiny little subset of the bits we see. But actually, all this stuff is going on behind the scenes.
Mm.
I don't know, it's been my time.
I just think it's interesting how literature explores this. Another one, actually, Sean, is Benjamin Button, isn't it? There was a movie about that. Where he sort of, I think I didn't see it. He goes from an old man back to a younger man, doesn't he? Yes.
That's Barry. Just thoughts going back to the Zorba situation. The missing link there are personal psychologists, and when faced with particular time constraints, either in excess or too little, or whatever it happens to be, some of us react in particular ways, and others in others, and there isn't a right way, or necessarily a preferred way. And if you live for the day, as Zorba presumably did, you'd this carpe diem approach is exactly the right one for him. Perhaps in a corporate environment faced with time constraints, some of us will panic and still things, other of us will prioritise and do the first two because that's what we have done. So I'm suggesting that the missing link is our psychology and our non-homogeneity.
I guess we're all rather different about this, are we not? I gave you one personal example. I'll give you another one. My father, he was 90 years old. He'd become infirm, and I had to kind of do things for him, and I had to get organized a new washing machine. So he got it all fixed up, he saw it working, he was really dead pleased with it. 90 years old, he turned to me and he said, "How long's the guarantee?"
You have me really puzzling, sir. I've just found it out here. The time is was actually recorded by an American group and sung. The group's name was "It's a Beautiful Day," and that's completely irrelevant. It was going around my head, so it was turned into a song.
I now know more about it, thank you.
We also see the purple for Mickey one of their songs, if anybody cares.
I just, if I may, mention one other quotation I didn't mention. Bob kindly dug this out for me, and I didn't fit it in, but I think it's a rather good one, actually. From Victor Hugo, "L'homme qui rit," which means "the man who smiled."
Man who laughs.
Man who laughs, right, thanks. The quotation is, "What is history? An echo of the past in the future. Then a shadow of the future on the past." Honest, fascinating. Well, it's all causation in two ways.
What I think is interesting about the relation between fiction and what we think about as reality is when we make a claim such as, we said Donald Trump will win the next election, then we seem to be making a fictional claim at some point if it is false. But if it's not false, then you've actually made a claim about fact. So I'm just sort of wondering what's... I don't know quite what the question is, but there seems to be something strange that we can make these claims that are actually fictions, and then they sort of almost become true or false at some future point in time. Does that make sense?
I'm beginning to look towards Bob for this, but...
It's a strange way in which maybe logic and reality might come together or might part in different ways. Because in literature we know that we're writing, well, you know, we believe that we're parting from reality.
Yes.
And yet sometimes we find it's actually tracking reality. A, in the sense that when we are engaging in literature, it sort of becomes real for us. In the time when we're reading it, we are there in that present moment. It's real in that moment. But when we think about it and reflect on it, we know we're reading literature, so of course it's not real.
Yeah, and Taggart had two arguments against the establishment of his A and B series, and one of the objections was that is the story in Don Quixote part of his past, present, future? And he took the view, no, because it's not, it is fiction and not time, and therefore you can exclude it. And that doesn't answer your question, is any future prediction fiction until it becomes fact?
Yes, but it may also align in with the idea that time maybe isn't as real as we think it
yes.
is. It's somehow that we are making time real. We are making that moment. We are settling it when we say something is true about time. Mm.
Yes.
Well, are there any other questions specifically for Barry?
Just something that came to mind is Paul Ricoeur is a French philosopher, so I find quite difficult reading, but I think in some of his work he wrote that three blocks is called Time.
Who's sorry?
Paul Ricoeur, R-I-C-O-U-R, was and died about 10 years ago. Well, very long. But he tried bringing together, I think, philosophy. Some aspects of it, but also history writing, French history writing. And the case, the only case I know well enough to detail is Brodel's Mediterranean, where he works on a kind of three stage of what he called the Swallow Age, which was not quite geologic time, but certainly processes that might take hundreds of years to become evident. You had very static patterns of agriculture or the geography in the Mediterranean country. And then the cultural tour, which is more 20 or 30 year economic cycles, and then the event history, which was in traditional political history, you know, Valley of Lepanto, if you want to see that. But I was wondering whether you had run into it, putting this together, whether you run into any resonances of that particular style of French philosophy around the tour, and sort of a mixture of phenomenology
No, I don't know if anybody else has. I personally haven't done something on literature, you know, like Roland Barthes, like mentioned, yeah. And so forth, but not that particularly.
I think what is interesting about him, before and a few of people, I think possibly Gadamer does this as well, but I mean, there is some attempt to bring in historic writing as a form of literature. I mean, it's constrained
yes.
possibly more by facts than conventional literature, but there's still
yeah.
an element of literature.
Well, if you turn to England and away from France, there has been an enormous debate with postmodernist critiques of history
yeah.
by saying that history is actually like fiction. It's a narrative always written from the perspective of certain people, both at the level of the writing and the level of the source material, and thus it needs to be seen as literature. And the answer to that that is usually made is that let's keep the facts sacred and keep the interpretations different. But even the facts have been challenged sometimes. Yeah, but that's been a big big debate in this.
Yes, although I mean in a way the narrative element is almost planned both sides. Lawrence Stoner, who is another historian, English from the very definitely not postmodernist, also was writing about returns to narrative
Yes. Yeah, I think the view, I've forgotten the name of this professor, Cambridge professor, who wrote a book now in defense of Evans, yes, thank you. And his view was, we cannot go the whole hog with this sort of relativist approach that it's all anybody's view. You have to actually draw the line somewhere, which is what are the facts we can reasonably establish. But what he has also conceded is that their approach is good because it throws us back into looking at the perspectives and the nature of the sources and so on. So it's been a helpful dialogue from which he's going to survive, I think.
I think it must be a theory that talks about a narrative arc that can be applied to literature, almost any literature at all. I can't see how some of the idea of the narrative arc can apply to some of your examples here. And as a sort of subset of that, if the Bible is considered literature, forgetting the theology, but if you consider it literature, there's a narrative arc in that which is to do with prophecy, times to come, which people argue is full of prophecy. That doesn't seem to fit into any of your bracket in introductory remarks, time passing, time passing. And that's a sort of mixture of the narrative arc and times yet to come.
Yes, I thought at one time I might put something in about prophecy and fatalism, which may be related. But you've only got so many words, and I, in the end, left that aside. I came across a super article, I think I mentioned to Bob, on a very long article on the Iliad, and it was about mortality and prophecy and destiny and so on and so forth. I didn't quite know where time fitted into that. I mean, it may go closer towards what Bob was saying, sort of the propositions about the future, prophecy, fatalism, I don't know.
I wonder if within the literature you could examine time relating to a thought becoming the writing. It's quite interesting, the 1920s, 30s playwright Pirandello writes six characters in search of an author. And to my what he says is that the moment you have a thought, that thought is the purest part of the literature. Because then when you take the time to write that thought down, it actually loses something. When somebody then reads what you've written, in that sense of the time, it loses more. And when an actor then portrays what has been written, it loses something else. And finally, when the audience listen to what that actor is saying, it loses something else yet again. So you've got a time scale from the thought to the execution. I wondered if that was something that had come into your...
Only in reverse, really. Because I think someone like Roland Barthes, in what he wrote in The Death of the Author, would say, once you actually write something, or perform something, or something like that, you're essentially losing control of it. It's about like we've lost control of the English language, it's driven by others now. And this is when other people read it and so forth, and they will have their own interpretations of it. And that book by Rob Grier, Jealousy, you could have all sorts of angles on what that actually means and what it's getting at. And this, I think, thus it is not a successive loss, it's actually a gain, because the audience interacts with what was put out there to excite it to do so.
But it still could be a loss of the pure thought that person has had in one sense, but it opens it up to interpretation. So you've got half a dozen different variations of that thought when it comes to the people that are interpreting it.
I've been an active NIMBY in our area, trying to get development stopped. And one of the problems is, as a lawyer will tell you, that there is no property in a view. So if someone wants to build some wretched house behind you, that is it. And I think this is almost the same with an author's work. There is no property in a view. Now, you may want to know what the author thought about it, but I think people like Barth would say far more interesting to see how it can be interpreted and reinterpreted.
Now, can I suggest perhaps that we have a few minutes break and then we come back for the say 10 minutes, if that's suitable. And thank you very much, Barry.